Hi, and welcome to Just Add Popcorn, a podcast where me and a bunch of my friends get together and talk about movies we've seen and watched and enjoyed.
So what movie are we talking about today, Flannel?
Today, we are going over Glass Onion and Knives Out, two movies in a series that both focus upon a singular detective going through rather intriguing mysteries.
First thing I would actually like to bring up today is the fact that Rian Johnson directed this movie. And this is Knives Out and Glass Onion. Knives Out is being one of my favorite movies of all time. I just don't understand how this man went from directing The Last Jedi, which was an absolute travesty to the Star Wars franchise, and then making these two movies. How does one do that?
See, I saw a YouTube comment when I was watching the movie, and it touched upon how, like, Knives Out and Glass Onion were, like, a better use of his writing chops, to quote the comment. So it could just be that The Last Jedi just wasn't the genre he was best at writing.
There's also the amount of freedom you have in writing something. When it's an independent project like Knives Out and Glass Onion are, you can pretty much just throw caution to the wind and write whatever you want. Yeah. When you are working for the Hideous Mouse, you kind of have to do whatever they tell you to do.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Wasn't there also like a huge turnover? Like, between, like, a lot of, like, the crew, between, like, all three of the sequel movies?
Honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. Considering how, like, kind of shoddily put together those movies were.
But I really do think with Knives Out, we get to kind of see, like, some of the strengths here. Because it's a very good movie.
Yeah, that's, totally.
I enjoyed a lot of it, and I gotta admit that usually I'm not entirely fond of sitting through like murder mystery movies like that. But there was something about that did not feel as tedious as they tend to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I will also say, like, Benoit Blanc is probably my second favorite detective in movies that I've seen, short of Hercule Poirot. He's just a delight to see on the screen. And I genuinely think it is one of the few times I've heard someone do a Northern Mississippi accent properly.
Oh, 100%. Like, total props to Daniel Craig for that.
Mm-hmm. He was, like, a little bit over the top with it, but not enough that it was bad.
Yeah.
It was, like, just the right amount of camp.
It's also very unexpected when you see Daniel Craig and then you first hear him speak and hear that accent come out of him after hearing him with a British accent for all those years.
Oh, tell me about it. I come from a James Bond family. I knew him from Casino Royale. As soon as I saw him start saying things in that accent, I was like, huh?
Who is this person? What's going on?
Excuse me, sir. Who are you?
Yeah, also, I think what made me enjoy this movie so much was their use of flashbacks while they're telling, like, their accounts of the story and while we're... And it like sort of gives us as an audience a view into what Blanc is thinking, for lack of a better. It gives us a good visual on that sort of point.
Absolutely, and one of the things that I caught on to, like very easily, is that, like, how like through very subtle details. You could see sort of not just I said this earlier, and I knew that I was going to trip up over this. I'm just going to call him by his last name. Blanc, sort of, besides his sort of thought process, you can see sort of the other characters' priorities based off of who is in, because, like, who is sitting next to Harlan, standing next to Harlan during, like, the big birthday party celebration, and what is being said. One of the details that I thought was so interesting, and it annoyed me a lot when watching for the first time, was how many times people did not know where Marta was from, or and her family were originally from. Because you get, like, Paraguay, Uruguay, Ecuador was another one.
Yeah, I think just that, it shows how, like, little the family cared about her. Like, when all was said and done, they just viewed her as
the help.
Someone who, yeah, someone who was here and who would be gone as soon as their dad died.
Sort of lightly segueing, the score for Knives Out, I thought, was really good. It's very interesting to know that, Nathan Johnson, the composer, is apparently, what was it, Ryan Johnson, the director's cousin. I was not expecting that at all. And then doing a little bit of research on my own time, as I was thinking, something that really was interesting was that normally a composer would get the final shots of the movie after the, you know, like, final production and all that, and usually write and adjust the scores accordingly, depending on that. But what was unique was that Nathan Johnson was writing the score during the production and would consistently, like, come on to set. And he, I think he was mainly supposed to not be in the loop as much as, like, the audience would, and reflect the score accordingly. And I thought that was really cool. I ramble for the day.
Honestly, yeah, I do remember the score being, like, really good. It's a much more subtle thing in movies like Knives Out and Glass Onion, but when you're paying attention to the story, the music 100% is going to be affecting how you are seeing things. Dramatic music is going to affect a scene more than, like, a lighthearted tune. You're less likely to, if you're hearing do 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 do, like, these kind of lighthearted notes, you're going to be like, okay, yeah, you know, nothing important's happening in the scene. And I feel like, I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, just the score or the ways that the shots are done or anything like that, but the way information is doled out to you is amazing. Because at no point in either one of the movies, I think, do you have the full story, like, right up until the end.
And with Glass Onion in particular, and I have no idea why this was the case, there was a lot of moments where it is either variations or sort of, like, just, like, a very subtle reference to a piece that already exists. So, like, from the get-go, from the very beginning of the movie, you have a much slower version of Johann Sebastian Bach, Little Fugue in G minor. One of my favorite pieces, for piano, period. You kind of know that something's up when it's a lot slower. And, you know, it plays into that. And then with the character Andy having a variation of Moonlight Sonata, there are very subtle references to that piece in there. But it's not enough where the where you could say that it is just the piece.
I also really enjoyed the puzzle box at the start of Glass Onion. I kind of understood a few of them before they talked it out. I was like, oh, this is what you need to do there. Oh, this is what this one is. Like, I could pick up on certain things, but there were other ones that I was just sitting there going, huh, don't know that one. And the way that it is used to portray, what was his name? Miles, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
Who was the
Edward Norton Miles?
Yeah, that guy who was putting everything on. Like, it was used to portray him as like this super genius, and then you find out, no, he just outsourced it. Like, he outsources everything. I was like, oh, that's hilarious.
Will admit that watching the movie, I just did not like. And I can understand that this was probably intentional, but I just did not like Miles at all because he constantly name drops famous people. Like, oh my god, wait, what? Philip Glass composing the drone tone for the hour. That is such an obnoxious thing to say to someone. Like,
isn't it like Jeremy Renner's hot sauce as well? Stuff like that.
Stuff like that, yeah.
It's like, it sounds like he's more or less basically like a walking advertisement for those things. Like, hey, famous people are associated with these things. You should get them.
Yeah, famous people like these. You should also like them.
I think we should move on to our final topic is the twists of both of these movies. The first movie, Knives Out, the twist at the end being that Chris Evans' character, I'm blanking on the name, was actually the one who attempted to kill their father.
Ransom.
Ransom, yes. What were you saying, Nina?
No, I was just trying to remember the name, sorry.
The fact that he wanted to... was the reasoning. It was because he kicked him out of the will or something, and then they knew that it would, if it was a murder, then the money would just be dispersed among everyone and he would still make money, correct?
It wasn't just that he was kicked out of the will, it was that Ransom knew first that Marta was going to be the one to inherit the entire estate. Yes. And all that.
And if he framed it so, and he tried to frame it so that Marta was the one that killed him, that killed what's his name, that killed him, so everyone, like, the money would be dispersed around to the whole family, so he would make money, so he would get money, and Marta would get nothing, and probably go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second movie, the twist is a lot less, like, I'd say obvious. The ending, just where they just call, where Benoit Blanc calls Edward Norton's character just an idiot. Is honestly one of the best scenes where he just explains how much of an idiot he actually is.
It's so stupid. It's brilliant. No, it's just dumb.
Yeah, they're I mean, I can definitely talk to the first point a little more about the Chris Evans character. Did Chris Evans had like what? An hour, not even a total of an hour of screen time throughout the entire movie, of Knives Out, and like most of it was just the same shot or the same scene, but from different angles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really cool. You know, that like they don't build up Hugh as like this big deal at first, because of the fact that they used him so, like, much less.
I actually think that's where we have time. That's all we have time for today. So, I'm going to send us off into the Netherlands. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.